Welcome to Genuine Life Recovery. We're here to help you and your loved ones overcome addictions and other addiction-related mental health challenges. In this show, we dive into the physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual aspects of addiction, mental health, recovery, family dynamics, codependency, and more. You can listen on your favorite app or at jodystevens.org. Genuine Life Recovery is made possible by great friends like Joshua's Heart, in memory of Joshua Brent Moore, bringing hope, love, and awareness to those afflicted by addiction, online at joshasheart.org, and Jody Stevens Productions for commercial voiceover, narration, production, MC, and public speaking, online at jodystevens.org. Hey friends, welcome back. I am joined by Eric Fisher. He is a certified counselor in the Calgary, Alberta, Canada area. We have a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about various forms of treatment, causes of addiction, assessments, all kinds of fun stuff, but we're going to make it not super clinical. At least that's the plan. Eric's got over 13 years experience working in outpatient and inpatient settings. We'll talk about what that is. He is a master practitioner of accelerated resolution therapy and EMDR. Both of those work on treating trauma, and we'll talk about that. He's also a professional consultant for Harmonized Health, a local organization providing an integrative treatment approach for people struggling with mental health and addiction challenges. Integrated is a good word. And we'll talk about what that means too. And Eric's got a private practice. You are a busy guy, recovery arts counseling, which helps individuals, couples, and families locally and remotely. His first book is The Martial Arts of Recovery, How to Subdue Addiction and Achieve Mental Wellness. That comes out May of 2024. We'll have to have you back on to talk about your book, Eric.
Sure.
Yeah. Hey, thanks so much for being here. And did I see in your bio you have some black belts? You're a martial arts guy?
Yes, I've done martial arts in the past when I was around 10 to 12 with Wataru, and also when I was later in my teenage years with American Kenpo and Jiu-Jitsu. Yeah.
Wow. What is Jiu-Jitsu?
Jiu-Jitsu has a lot of grappling, a lot of locks, a lot of takedowns, and so it's just a certain form of martial arts. Yeah.
Really good, like, I have a friend who does that. She has this whole like self-defense program, and she works with women and girls rescued from like sex traffic and stuff like that. And she empowers them through, like, it's an emotional process too, of the punching and the kicking, right? There's like a lot going on there, more than just the physical, right?
Yes, it can be very cathartic. Yes.
Wow. Okay. All right. So you're in Calgary. What's the weather been like? So as I speak, I'm in Reno. We just had about 2 feet of snow here and about 10 in the mountains, and everything's been shut down for 3 days. Did you guys get any of this weather?
Yes, we've had some snow in February. Okay. It's usually the coldest month, but actually it was amazing. And wow. March, we got a big dump a few days ago.
Uh-huh.
And so getting some more moisture, which we need. So a little bit different for me now.
Yeah, but still it spread all the way up there. So Eric, thanks again for being here. It sounds like you do a lot in the world of addiction and recovery, which is so super cool. What led you into this particular profession, particularly dealing with people struggling with addictions and trauma?
Oh, short story. I was working in an outpatient clinic in Mississippi, and
that's where I hear the accent.
Yeah, like, I'm from Tennessee, but
okay. I was like, yeah. That just doesn't seem Canadian to me. It's I was about expecting you to say "ma'am" or something like that. I'm like, okay, so oh my gosh. So are you? How did you end up in Canada? Okay, well, yeah. Finish your story.
I lived most of my life in Tennessee before coming up to Calgary. So yes, I might say yes, ma'am, at some point.
I love it.
I was working in Mississippi, and I was working in an outpatient clinic there for mental health. And I wasn't billing enough Medicaid according to where I was working. And long story short, I was told either we get you in another position or you're going to be let go. And so I was like, okay, all right, well, I'd like to, you know, continue working here. And my supportive supervisor, she was able to advocate for me to start work at an inpatient treatment center that was mostly for addiction, but also for mental health. And that's how I got my start in addiction, which was very much trial by fire.
Yeah. Wow. So how did you end up in Canada from Mississippi? I must have missed that part.
My wife is from Canada. She's from Calgary. Okay. So I surrendered up here back in 2014. We lived in Mississippi for 10 months after being married, went to New Zealand for 15 months, and then came to Calgary.
So what's the insurance and all that? Like what's the main difference? I mean, you don't have to get too technical, but in our medical system when it comes to mental health and up there.
It's a little bit different up here because of the social medicine and people right. don't have to necessarily pay to see like a doctor, yet there is there's still insurances that have to be used when someone goes to see like a psychologist, social worker, therapist.
Mm. Do you like that system better than here or what? Just out of curiosity.
But I do, based on what, you know, happened in my job as far as telling me you're not billing enough. And then, you know, I don't get to work with the people that didn't have maybe Medicaid. And then the ones that were on Medicaid, I had to terminate the relationship very quickly, which was not in their best interest or mine for treatment.
Yeah.
And so there is that concern. Of course, that can happen up here in Canada as well. If maybe someone doesn't have their insurance anymore or something else happens.
There's so many problems in addiction treatment. You know, it's crazy. Talk to me a little bit about your journey of faith. So you're a Christian, right? Were you raised in a Christian family? Did you come to the faith later in life?
Yes, I was raised in a Christian family in the church. If you need a name for that church, the Church of Christ, and got baptized when I was almost 13. It was August of 98, so I would have been almost 13. And yeah, I've grown up in the faith. I would go to a church here in Calgary now. And the reason I went to New Zealand was because a brother in the church was having a spiritual emergency. And I basically just stopped working where I was working in that inpatient drug treatment facility. And my wife and I just up and went to New Zealand and helped her friend out or something.
How fun to see all those different places and stuff like that. I mean, so are there a lot of Christians where you are in Calgary?
You know, not as much as where I'm at. I'm from in Tennessee. That's
right. Well, yeah.
Yeah. I would not as much. I mean, it is a big city here.
Yeah.
However, it's different. Like, it's hard to describe.
It's becoming less and less Christian everywhere every day, I think, if we look at it from the, you know, the biblical perspective, and all the people will fall away or be deceived. And of course we could, that's like a whole, a whole nother, you know, discussion. But I'm curious, I worked for a Christian radio for 17 years. I've been in radio 31 years. So met a lot of Christian artists and stuff like that. Were you near Nashville?
I was probably about an hour and 40 minutes east of Nashville in a town called McMinnville. It's a small town.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think I've met a lot of artists that were from there, you know, there or something like that. So,
nice.
So let's talk about in initial treatment, someone comes in with a addiction challenge, the initial assessment. What is the importance of that assessment? And what is an assessment and what does it determine for people listening? Because I think this, to me, is just a very important piece of the process up front. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, what I've heard from some folks when it's very comprehensive is it's like being introduced to myself for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would say to define an assessment would be from a biopsychosocial spiritual perspective, being able to ask questions with those four domains, medical, psychological, social, and spiritual, to gain an understanding of where someone's at in that time, but also past history, which gives us a good full picture of what level of treatment, what could be the possible diagnosis, what could be the different treatment modalities, different treatment approaches that could be used. Just get to know the person better.
Yeah. Cause cool. People are always like, oh, well, what causes addiction? You know, is it just genetics? And I always say, yeah. Is it psychological? Yeah. Is it spiritual? Yeah. You know, I think we want an answer, right? And you deal with this in therapy all the time, is that there is really no one answer, right?
There's not. I wish that there was a single primary catalyst for what causes addiction. However, there's so many different factors.
Yeah. Kind of talk a little bit about the biopsychosocial initial assessment and what that is. I know I worked for an opiate treatment center. And that's where I got an MA in addiction or MS in addiction counseling, but I did my practicum there and we always had to do that. And it was always like, did you get the biopsychosocial, biopsychosocial, you know, but it was a very important piece. And it's really just looking at the person's sort of risk factors, right? I mean, if someone comes in, say, and I'll let you expand on this too, and they're homeless. So that's social, right? That's a big piece. We've got to really hone in on that versus maybe there's mental health or schizophrenia or something like that. That's going to be sort of a different focus, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, my first day at the inpatient treatment facility in Mississippi, I had like three assessments. I had to teach a psychoeducation class and then I had like a session. I was like, whoa, this is way too much. Sink or swim. So talking about the biopsychosocial spiritual, I'll give you what Harmonized Health does, which is really amazing. So we're able to do what's called a CT, comprehensive treatment evaluation, which goes through, I mean, we could be here all day talking about all the different questions, but
I know. Yeah. It goes it's through, long. It's like, you know, 2 hours or something. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. So we go through family history, mental health, addiction history with family, medical history, prior hospitalizations, all that. But what's really awesome is I get to have a sober second thought with another clinical professional to see if I've missed anything or any additional recommendations. And then we have a bunch of people that have some funding that we can give to these clients with other there's one that's a clinical hypnotist. There's one that does intergenerational family trauma work that will be funded for the person. There's one that does family mediation. So there's all of these different referral resources we can give, and funds are really not a concern. And so, there's also a peer community coordinator, and she's in recovery herself, and she's able to work with these folks on a community level, on a peer level. So, what was the original question? Sorry about that.
No, that was perfect. I think that you really described it well. And then that kind of gets into the integrative treatment. You know, it's weird, like it started that way, like with AA and stuff, where the alcoholic would end up in the hospital and then they would have, you know, at least some medical treatment. And then it switched to like where everything got separate. So mental health and addiction were not the same thing. I have a lot of friends who are therapists and they're like, well, I just don't deal with addiction. And it's like, well, why not? Because it's not that different than any other thing that you would treat. But we really got away, like it's just now they're starting to come back into this integrative treatment. And what that really means is, well, yeah, talk to me about that. It just means that you're working under one roof with specialists in every area of well, so like in the opiate center, there was methadone too and things like that and different medications. So you also had a medical staff. And then you had psychiatrists and psychologists, not enough, like never enough here. And then you had addiction counts. So you kind of had the gamut based on the person's needs. Mm-hmm.
That's right. It's multidisciplinary, whether it's
that word
or buprenorphine or whatever they need for opiate for help with opiates, and yeah, psychiatrist, doctor, nurse, clinical team with counselors or psychologists. Yeah, when I worked at an inpatient here in Calgary, it was the detox had all those components. We had the nurse, the doctor, the counselor, all under one roof.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and then everybody kind of meets, right? And they go over the new patients. I think a lot of people don't
Yes.
realize that it's if you're in a good place, right? It's pretty involved. Just like doctors would meet before they do just a cancer treatment. You know, we don't realize that, but there's a lot of behind the scenes, right?
There totally is, yeah, more than what people usually think, like you said.
Talk to me about the ASAM, these levels of care. This, I think, is so in addition to getting an assessment, meaning like what we talked about, where you come in and we just kind of determine where you're at, the risk factors based on family history, based on genetics, based on maybe how you were raised, et cetera, et cetera. We kind of covered that. But the levels of care, I think, is a big deal. This is assessing, right, the type of treatment someone needs. And so often people end up in the wrong sort of place, the wrong treatment. And I think that I don't know if it's detrimental or not. I mean, I'd love your thoughts on that. I know some people say, you know, any treatment works if you work it, but it's probably certainly easier if you're in something that's matched to the level of care that you need. So talk to me about that. What is the ASAM levels of care and how important is that? That was a long question.
Sure.
Wasn't really a question, but you get it.
It was a statement
It was a
question hybrid. Yeah.
statement. It was Jody's opinion. I'm leading the witness,
And there's some weight to that opinion. There's some weight to that statement. So I would say that the first tier, so to speak, would be, I think they call it like 0.5. I could be wrong, but it's all about not even individual counseling. It's just psychoeducation, so more of a preventative possibility. Like, I'm giving information for someone that might be at risk, but they haven't got to a place where they're having concerns with addiction. The next step up would be,
Oh, I was just going to say really quick, and this helped me a lot when I got my education, because people would come to me and they were problem drinkers, but they weren't alcoholics, and I didn't know the difference. And so I was always like, well, you should go to AA or come to a meeting or do this thing. And they're like, but I only drink once a week. But when I do drink, I always get drunk. And, you know, and that helped me a lot because I was suggesting they do all this recovery stuff, but they weren't there yet. They were a problem drinker. And I think that was a big deal. So that's one level of care where you're just, you know. So anyway, continue on with that. But I thought that was really helpful for me.
Yeah, totally. You know, like there's that, yeah, the spectrum as you're talking about, where it's like no use, maybe recreational, experimental use, misuse, and then dependence slash addiction, perhaps. So yeah, so there is that psychoeducational piece that can be done. Next step up would be outpatient, so one-on-one counseling, perhaps, if there is a concern, but they don't require either like an intensive outpatient program, which would be the next step up, which I think is around 9 hours or so a week, something like that. When I did a
I think so.
I facilitated a program like that, and it was 10 hours or so a week, 2 hours each day in the evening. And after that's partial hospitalization, I think that's around 20 hours a week, but less than 24 hour supervision. And then there's the actual residential treatment, which is what I've worked in before, which is where someone stays. And I think there's three different levels to residential treatment. Don't have to go into those. And then there's the like actual inpatient treatment, which I see more as being like in a hospital for like 24/7 supervised medical care, which is often for people that are like in severe withdrawal and detox.
So basically, it's and how do you determine where someone's supposed to go? I think one of the things I noticed with the ASAM, particularly working, and this is probably what you ran into, is in my opinion, when you're dealing with people addicted to heroin and fentanyl, they all need inpatient. but none of them are getting it. So you're doing this ASAM thing. A lot of them are homeless. You want to say that they score really high, but then you really can't because there's nowhere for them to go because they're all on Medicaid. So you just sort of, it just, it, something was off about that, you know? So mm-hmm. I feel like they should use that as a standard, but you can't really, because then it's like if they're too high, like on the ASAM score, then you can't treat them. So then, but then there's nowhere to put them. So what do you do? Like, it kind of, talk to me about that, because that was a challenge for me, because there isn't, you know, you're dealing with addicts that aren't going to get the level of care that they need because there's nowhere for them to go. So do you say, oh, they've scored super high, and then you can't treat them at all? You know what I mean? Maybe put that in everyday language, but
it's a problem up here too, Jody. Like, okay. we'll have people that need that detox right away, and there's only one or two mm-hmm. like places to do detox as far as like for public health care, like in the city. And one of those is in Renfrew. And I worked at a place with the private detox. And so it's like, oh yeah, you can go here, but then you have to get there like 7 or so in the morning and get picked. And hopefully you're the one that gets picked. But what if I don't get picked? I'm out on the street again, or I have to wait and I'm going through this withdrawal. So that's what Harmonized Health, what I've been able to consult with, we're able to give direction and some resources for people so they don't feel like there's nothing that they can do.
Yeah.
You know, for themselves, there's funding and stuff. It comes to be at a harm reduction perspective, or maybe I'll do some sessions one-on-one and try to do some type of, is there some different protective factors that we can tap into, like family support or support in the community or mm-hmm. drop-in shelters or something for you if you're having a hard go.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't been in the States for a while, so I'm a little detached from that, uh-huh. but I would say when I was there in the States, especially when it came to methamphetamine, what happens if I can't get that certain level of treatment? And that's a very difficult question to answer.
It is. And most of those patients only have Medicaid. I do think there's a lot of places that will take you. It's just a matter of, there's just so many different things going on, you know, can you get the person in time? Because there's a period of time when they're ready. And then if they go back to use, you know, you don't have a very big window, and there's just such a shortage and there's such a waiting list. And, you know, it's like, oh, well, we can get you in 3 months, but that doesn't work. Cause like, we need it to get in now, you know,
right now, you know, like I could be in the grave in 3 minutes or in 3 hours. So
yeah,
it's no joke.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk to me about co-occurring disorders, what that is and which ones commonly occur with addiction, or what they call substance use disorder, which meaning different types of addictions. Mm-hmm.
ADHD.
Yeah, that's
ADHD
a big one.
A person with ADHD is 6 times more likely to have a substance use concern.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And the reason for that is because of the impulsivity that's part of that. And also, we're actually seeing in the research that ADHD is more so called executive functioning deficit disorder. And so the frontal lobe is not working in a proper way, in a healthy way, and it hurts someone's impulse, the ability to have it, the ability to say no, mm-hmm. put on the brakes. Wow. So we see that, especially if nicotine with ADHD is so prevalent, because it helps to increase dopamine levels in someone's brain, nicotine. And that's what someone with ADHD needs, because they have low dopamine levels.
Yeah.
Anyway, so ADHD being one, depression for sure.
Yeah.
Trauma, very much so. Complex PTSD, or just, trauma, PTSD itself. Anxiety. Those are the main ones. I mean, grief is a big one too. I mean, if I'm going through a lot of unresolved grief, a lot of prolonged grief, loss, then I might reach out for these substances or different behaviors to soothe.
I always think, you know, people do stuff for a reason. And I think that's important for, especially what we're trying to do is it's figuring out what is it for you? And then from there is, right, how do we replace that activity? Or how do we, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. What can we do instead of like the recovery capital piece, mm-hmm. you know, hedonic rehabilitation, ways, other ways to get pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I know for me, I was treating a lot of stuff, low self-esteem, being dyslexic. I don't know if there's a high prevalence of dyslexia in addiction, but you know, and then anxiety. I started in radio when I was really young and I began having panic attacks. And so, but when you're that young, you don't put in, right? I mean, we don't put any of this stuff together. We don't even know why we're doing what we're doing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like not even, it's kind of like the, I heard Gabor Mate mention this once, like three fish.
Oh, I love him.
Mm-hmm. You know, older fish comes to the other two younger fish. Hey, how about that water, young fish? And then the older fish swims away and the other two younger fish are like, what are water? What is water? You know, what's he talking about? Because we're so surrounded by something that we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do we know, how do you determine, let's say somebody comes in and they have a severe mental health issue. Can you treat them both together, the mental health, the substance? How do you know which one to tackle first?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I would say when it comes to co-occurring, if they both can be treated at the same time, mm-hmm. that would be the most beneficial. However, with trauma, oftentimes people will come into treatment and they're more spotlighting the trauma, yeah. which all well and good. That's something they've been through. However, if addiction is not treated first, then often people will continue to relapse, continue to have problems with the addiction because the trauma is continuing to trigger them because it's not being treated. The addiction's not being treated. So if it's possible to do some relapse prevention, some work with addiction holistically, getting some coping skills, whatever treatment that's used, and then starting to segue into trauma-informed therapy, that would be helpful. Of course, though, I mean, if someone wants to do both, then okay, we'll work on both. That's fine, but it does help. It does help to work on kind of honing in on the addiction and making sure, because there's a lot of overlap even with those two treatments, with coping skills, so.
Yeah, there is. I think it's super important to at least remove the substance for a while, because otherwise you can't tell. I mean, so yeah, you know, if someone's doing methamphetamine a lot, that can mimic paranoia. I mean, you know, because a lot of times they'll mimic each other. And then marijuana, which is supposed to be so great. Well, I think we're finding out it's just not so great. And I know because I smoked a lot of it, you know. So I, you know, a lot of these things can mimic one another, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, they can bounce off each other. They can mimic one another. Yeah. Like even with depression can be seen. Like shame and addiction is so pervasive and it can look like it's depression, or depression can actually maybe be seen more like actually shame. So yeah, being able to work on them in tandem, if you know, can be done.
Yeah. For sure. What are some of your favorite treatments for addiction and trauma or both?
Yeah. I did see when you sent me out the outline, there were some that I use. So cognitive behavioral therapy for sure.
Yeah.
I do like motivational interviewing. So how does this align with somebody's values, with the changes that they're going to make, and just rolling with the ambivalence, trying to develop discrepancy between the trajectory to go. And I also do accelerated resolution therapy that you mentioned earlier as a supplement to the traditional treatments for addiction. And that's more of an eye movement based therapy, changing negative images to positive images in the brain. Sometimes EMDR for addiction, but not a lot of times.
Yeah.
And yeah, just going through basic relapse prevention skills holistically. So biopsychosocial, spiritual, but definitely honing in on the addictive thinking piece with relapse prevention.
Do you think that like cognitive behavioral therapy feels like it's sort of in every piece of it? I remember when I was studying, it was like, okay, what's not CBT? Like it's so, but a lot of it is just change your thoughts and you'll change what you do. Does that work real well with trauma, or do you have to do something a little more involved? Like how well does CBT work with trauma?
It can be a good starting point from what I've seen. However, I often will use some of the more, I'll call them heavy hitters like EMDR and ART, accelerated resolution therapy.
What's that? What's talk to me about that one. I don't know that one.
Accelerated resolution therapy was developed by a lady named Lainey Rosenzweig in the Northeast. She was getting trained in EMDR and she was like, hey, I see a different way of doing this.
Uh-huh.
And so she developed this therapy, which is more about working on images and sensations as compared to EMDR, which is more about cognitions and feelings, so to speak. And so what's happened? Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I would say EMDR is more the right brain, left brain, right? Where we flip things around so that it gets processed, almost like dreaming. When we dream, you know, we wake up and we're like, oh, I feel a little better.
It's kind of totally. And ART does use eye movements as well, a little bit differently. And so we're changing, it's called positization, changing negative images to positive images. So the tagline of the therapy is keep the knowledge, but lose the pain. So I keep the facts about what happened to me. It's not like it's amnesia, but I put something in front of the memory, if it's a trauma. It's a lot more relieving, a lot more beneficial, a lot more positive.
When you say put something in front of it, you mean like a different thought, a different belief system or something like that?
It's actually changing the entire memory itself.
Oh, wow. That sounds really cool. How important is like processing emotions? And not so much processing them, but sort of sitting through them, getting to the other side of things. I think we, you know, when I was younger, I bailed out a lot. In other words, I would feel things and then I would numb them. And then as I got older, everything sort of triggered me. Now I try to work through and just at least identify what I'm feeling. And I think that's really helpful. I think we don't do that. So we don't even know, like for me, I was like a sock drawer, just overflowing with crazy emotions. And it took years to unstuff all that and figure out what was going on. And I think we're trained that way, you know, don't feel that way. And just to kind of shove all this stuff. And a lot of people think they're going to have to do all this crazy stuff. And I always say, you know, it's not, especially for guys, right? It's not, you don't have to like go deep and cry and sob, but there are ways to just work through this stuff, right? Instead of bailing out.
Yeah, men do have a difficult time generally, for sure. And you're opening up the sock drawer. Here's a blue sock and a red sock and a black sock and all these different feelings. I once had another counselor tell me, and she's in recovery herself, that feelings are like kids. You can't let them drive and you can't put them in the trunk either. You know, can I drive? But, you know, I'm sitting there with that feeling, not letting them drive, and I'm driving. Feelings are in the passenger seat. I'm being able to feel, and thawing out is really difficult, eh? Like, it's the thawing out piece that's almost the hard. It's harder than the actual, like the being cold. Yeah, it's difficult, but thawing, like you talk about all the different feelings.
Yeah,
that's a lot. It hurts to thaw out.
Yeah,
from that numbness.
Yeah,
and I would say just be gentle, eh? Like one feeling at a time, one step at a time.
Yeah. I think once we can kind of get to the root of some of this stuff, though, it can be, I don't know, like for me, there were a lot of triggers. And so something would happen and it would take me back to when I was 5 and I didn't really understand what was happening, but now I do. And it's a lot easier. It's not super involved. Like, okay, so I'm a skier, okay, and I teach downhill skiing, and I'm trying to get the certification, and I thought it would be really easy. Well, it's not. It's a professional sport, and it's been really, so they have these dinners where they call you out, you know, and being dyslexic and being told I was stupid, they called me out, and I went blank, and I couldn't talk, and I was triggered to when I was five, and all that, you know, when it was awful, and I left the dinner, and I'm never going back, and all this stuff, and then I kind of thought about it. And I cried just for a few minutes, and I understood exactly what happened to me. And I just sat through it, figured it out, got through to the other side, knew that this guy kind of reminded me of my dad or all those male teachers. Like, I understood what was happening. And then it made it okay. You have to kind of sit through the emotion. And then I said, okay, so if it weren't for these people, that you think are judging you, when actually they're probably just trying to help you, would you still go get that certification? Like, if it weren't for that, would you still do it? And the answer was, yeah, I still would. Right. So it made it okay. But I had to, normally I would just, you know, F everything and I would quit and give up and move on to something else. And now I look at my life and why I have so many quote talents, because I was always punting based on that. But that's just one example of like triggers, sitting through it, figuring it out. And then like later on, I felt so much better, you know? I don't know. What's your take on that?
Yeah. Like a release then, like felt better, like a release, like.
I think so. Just understanding what happened instead of being triggered. Like, that's the kind of stuff that used to make me drink. And I never really processed what was happening to me, you know?
Yeah. I think a lot of us can be motivated by shame or guilt or things like that from other people. And we start to come to the realization, yeah, it's not for me to take on. Like, okay, I'm having this response. Could be a traumatic response. And then I'm able to process that and come to a place where I'm advocating more for me. My emotions can function to protect me. And yeah, so I would, yeah, emotions are tricky, because a lot of times we're powerless over what we come to feel. However, we can respond in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to understand what we're feeling, to sort of name it?
Yep, name it to tame it. Yeah, absolutely. I think emotional intelligence is super important. And even when it comes to self-regard, that's important with emotional intelligence. I don't beat myself up for having maybe a certain feeling.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So let's talk about, do you do Christian counseling, or basically, like, is there different approaches in Christian versus non-Christian counseling? I mean, I know you basically work for a treatment center that doesn't necessarily say they do or they don't, but it's probably more just how we approach our worldview. What would you say?
Yeah. If someone wants to talk with me about like my experience with spirituality or what I believe, I'm more than happy to do that. However, I won't go out of my way to give my experience usually. I don't want to encroach or, you know, make it seem like this person needs to look at my way of spirituality.
Right.
With Christianity. And so, like, one gentleman, when I was working in inpatient, he came and he asked me about my faith. He just kind of walked in my office and asked, and we talked about it, and it was great. And then there's other times where I can kind of tell where, this person's not ready to even talk about spirituality at all. And so it's definitely a listening game, and it's definitely an empathy piece too regarding where somebody's at.
But you definitely probably have a different approach, even though you don't know it, because you're not looking at the world from a purely scientific perspective. You know, people that aren't believers are like, well, we got to find a cure. It's all science. And of course, you know, it's going to get better in from a biblical perspective, you, I don't think addiction's totally. Getting better. I don't think mental health is getting better. You know.
Yeah. It's not going anywhere, and it's not getting better. And you know, I will throw out some scripture references without saying they're scripture.
Yeah.
And people don't even probably realize that they're actually coming from the Bible.
Yeah.
I don't like quote the scripture, so to speak. But
yeah.
When it comes to maybe different feelings or different ways of like faith, perseverance, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah. So yeah, I definitely want to get to the spirituality piece at some point in the treatment when it comes to addiction, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that piece is really important. Do you see stigma around addiction and medication and things like that within the Christian community?
Oh yeah. You know, growing up, even from a family perspective, you know, just don't show these certain feelings, just get over it. Just have faith in God and everything's going to be, you know, a-okay, which there's nothing wrong with having that faith, yet there has to be some type of action with faith, I believe too.
Yeah.
I mean, like there's such thing as binging on spirituality where,
yeah.
Oh, you know, God's going to take care of it and I don't have to do anything and I'm good. And, but there's also the restricting piece too, where I don't have any type of connection with God, higher power. So I would say that, yeah, there is a stigma where it's about, oh, you're feeling down, you're depressed. Well, just pray to God and everything's going to be okay. Or, addiction. Well, and we'll probably get into this as well. As far as, is it a moral failure? Well,
yeah.
Hey, well, just stop using, you know, like just stop drinking, stop using opiates, stop gambling, whatever. And so there's this impatient presentation that from others that, hey, just do one thing different, perhaps, and it's going to be okay.
Yeah. And I think we're all like that, even Christian. I mean, my brother died of addiction in 15, and my dad was, you know, he's Mr. Science, and he's, you know, well, why can't he just stop? Well, it just doesn't work that way. And that was, I mean, you know, and he just felt so helpless because he couldn't fix it, you know, and it was just, it was horrible. I mean, my whole family just, they fell apart around his addiction. You know, of course, that's a whole nother family dynamics. It's a whole nother piece, but I don't know. I mean, that's a great question for God. It's like, how come there isn't a psychological manual? How come you don't just magic wand people? Like, why is it? I mean, I think, you know, we do come into this world that, you know, if we look at the fall, then everything is corrupt. That's kind of how I look at it. Our genes, our biology, our mental health, like everything, all of creation is groaning, right? So when they say what causes addiction, right? The world? The flesh, the devil. I mean, and there's that piece of it too. There's a spiritual piece, which they don't ever talk about in addiction recovery. But right, if someone comes in and they've been involved in witchcraft, I mean, you've got so many different things happening. And, you know, they're just, and that's like kind of a whole nother, right? Sort of a spiritual assessment, right?
Absolutely. My heart goes out to you for your loss.
Oh, thank you.
you're welcome. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
And yeah.
I totally get you when you talk about this corrupt world. And after Eden, partaking of the fruit.
Yeah.
And then sin and death, and addiction is death. Addiction can be that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have worked with a lot of folks, that I've been into crystals or which very new age type of approaches. Mm-hmm. And who's to say there's not some demonic forces that are at work here?
Yeah. I mean, there's totally that, you know, there's so many there, you know, again, the world, right, is corrupt. And so that can cause the addiction, and then the sins of the flesh, and then the spirituality. So I think it's, you're kind of assessing that too. So it is definitely complex. Talk to me about medication. You know, do you see stigma? We see stigma around medication too.
Oh, yeah, it goes back to that. Hey, just change the thought process, change this one or two things. Yeah, addiction's man-made, addiction's a band-aid, so to speak. It's not going to help you. And I mean, truth be told, even with medication-assisted treatment, medication for addiction, it can be very short-term. However, maybe I need that. It doesn't mean that I'm sinning when I'm partaking of the medication. I don't think. I think it's something that we can use along with faith. But yeah, there's definitely a stigma around that, especially when it comes to opiates or antidepressants, just those type of medications.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, we're trying to fix something in our brain that's broken. Right. And so like for me, I take a little bit of 5 milligrams of Lexapro, and it's just been completely life-changing. I mean, life-changing. Like, and then I quit taking it for a while, and then, you know, the menopause hit and all these things. And I'm like, you know what? I have to take that because I don't think there's anything wrong with that, especially if it helps with, well, for me, you know, I'd been sober a long time before I did that, but a lot of people, I mean, they're trying to fix what's broken with the addiction. So if I'm like ADHD, if I'm, you know, doing speed or drinking or something like that to try to fix this imbalance, but I can take sort of a slow release or whatever medication to fix the problem, or at least start to fix the problem and take down the addiction, like that's going to be way better, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I can take Vyvanse for ADHD, and I've heard a lot of adults that started taking that, and it was mind blowing. So much change. And if I can help myself with impulsivity in that way, with my planning, with my motivation with ADHD, and then could that help with the substance use if that's a concern?
Yeah.
Possibly. So, that's awesome that that's helped you along the way, Johnny.
I mean, I don't think it's sinful to take medication. I think it could be for some people. I think it just depends on your perspective. But I think for the most part, you know, God created that too, you know, doctors.
Yeah.
So,
He created men and women, doctors that can help prescribe and be vessels for those that need the help.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thanks for joining me. Is there anything that I missed? I want to talk about your book coming out and things like that, but is there anything like you're dying to say that I missed?
One piece I'll just tell folks, if they're struggling with something like this, is that everybody has value, you know, but not everybody adds value to my life. So boundaries are important for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But recognizing I have value, even if I'm in the darkest depths of addiction or mental health concerns. Anyway,
I love what you just said about boundaries. Everybody has value, but not everybody adds value to my life. Oh my gosh, I got to write that down. I'm stealing that.
I stole it from somebody else. Okay. So, you know, the best steal. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Talk to me about your book and the work you're doing and how people can get in touch with you.
Sure. So the book, The Martial Art of Recovery, it's coming out in May, as you mentioned, and it's all about the intersection of martial arts concepts and techniques for addiction recovery and mental health.
Wow. That's cool.
So it's been over 2 years in the making, and I'm using primarily concepts and techniques from American Kempo as the foundational material, and I also go into depression, anxiety, and trauma in that book as well, and it's a very much a how-to with all these different techniques and concepts.
Nice. And how can people get in touch with you if they want?
Instagram, Recovery Arts Counseling, and that's two L's because I'm up here in Canada, so we spell it differently than the States. And then on it's www.recoveryartscounseling.com, so like martial arts, but recovery arts. And also I'm on Facebook with Recovery Arts Counseling. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me or the Recovery Arts Counseling Private Practice. You can also see my branding on the Harmonize Health website as well, since I'm a contractor with them. So that's a few of the ones.
Now, when you say would you say two L's? What was that again? That you spelled
differently? That's where the counseling. So it's Recovery Arts Counseling with two L's instead of one L.
I did not know that.
I didn't either until I came to Canada.
Counseling is spelled with two L's. Okay. Now we'll be able to find you. All right. Well, Eric, thanks for joining us. Thank you for sharing your all of your great insight.
Thank you so much for having me, Jody. It's been a pleasure today.
Thank you so much, friends, for listening to Genuine Life Recovery, playing on your favorite app or on my website at jodystevens.org. It's JodieStevens, jodystevens.org. There you can check out my podcast, blog, recovery coaching info, speaking, and more. Check it out.